And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
Over the last 8 weeks, we have been building a series of lessons that I believe are some of the most important that an investor needs to learn. We focused on the selection of equity asset classes. We focused on how to combine those equity asset classes. We focused on how to combine those different combinations of equity asset classes with fixed income. We looked at the period of accumulation. We looked at the implications of starting with $1,000 a year, adding 3% a year to the contribution, and doing that over a period of 53 years with all of these 9 different strategies, with all of the different combinations of equities and fixed income. And then we looked at using what had been built to retire on as a source of income using both fixed and flexible distribution strategies. And finally, we focused on the 2 funds for life. While we did not do it as a part of the 8 weeks, we had earlier done a piece on the selection of ETFs. And we talked about the best-in-class ETFs that Chris Pederson has created. And all of this was done using the work, most of it, from Daryl Balls, of cranking out the numbers, building tables, looking to see what were the implications about return and risk, how bad did bad get, what was the worst year, the worst 3 months, 6 months, 36 months, 60 months, turning these numbers inside out in an attempt to give you some sense of what it might be like. Now, as luck would have it, one of our truth tellers, Ben Carlson, the fellow who writes A Wealth of Common Sense on a daily basis, 7 days a week, has written an article about backtesting. And not only did he write an article about it, a new article, but he also has links to several old articles on the same topic. And those articles, we've got links to those in the notes to this podcast. But I thought it was a perfect ending before we go back and review with Chris and with Daryl this whole series of lessons. Before we do that, I thought it would be good to focus on the implications of looking at the past and taking whatever numbers we have available to us and cranking them out and showing you all the different ways that we might look at those returns. In some cases, we go all the way back to 1928. Other cases, we go back to 1970. But the bottom line is that we are doing our best to take a look at the past in the hopes that that view will have something to do with the future. And that's what this article, or these articles, are about that Ben has written. And so I'm going to read parts of it. I'm going to discuss parts of it, and hopefully, as we think back over those 8 major topics, this will help give us perspective. Now, one of the things that I've said is that, having been around the business since the 1960s. I've made the point that investing has never been easier, nor has it been more efficient. The costs are lower, the cost of transactions, the cost of managing a mutual fund. Diversification has never been as broad as it is today because of the growth of the index funds. And we now have a Roth IRAs and 401ks that give us a tax efficiency that we haven't had in the past. And also, as Ben Carlson points out, it has never been as easy to look at the past as it is now. And one of these articles, the first one I'll refer to, is entitled 10 Things You Can't Learn from a Back Test. And I'll read here from his work. We're currently living in the golden age of the back test. Things have never been better for quantitatively inclined investors. There are algorithms on top of algorithms. We've never had so much historical market or corporate data available at the click of a button. Computing power is off the charts. Entry-level analysts can now perform calculations with Excel spreadsheets, and the world's smartest scientists and the mathematics could only dream about a generation or two ago. For finance history buffs such as myself, these tools are enormously useful. I can check historical performance going back many decades, backtest every strategy under the sun, quickly and easily perform scenario analysis, run thousands of Monte Carlo simulations, and dissect every type of market environment imaginable. There is, however, a downside to all of this. Here are 10 things you cannot learn from a back test. Number one, how many bad back tests came before the good ones? I wonder how many millions of deceased back tests there are right now sitting in a recycle bin graveyard on computer desktops all across the globe. No one ever shows you a bad back test because it's much easier to data mine the past than the future. And I've said this, by the way, many times. There's no risk in the past. We always know what we should have done. And these back tests give us that. And I think Ben is right. What you don't see are the ones that didn't work out. And that's a bias that I think is very important. And it is a bias that we would like to believe the work of Dr. Fama and Dr. French took into consideration. Well, number two, data availability at the time. The fact that we now have data that wasn't available in the past changes the nature of that past data. There would have been ripple effects if investors knew then what we know now. Hindsight changes perception. So just let me make a couple comments there. I think that's really important because in the 30s, for example, when there was amazingly high volatility, higher volatility than you have seen certainly in your lifetime, in my lifetime, but that volatility was partly caused because, number one, there weren't that many investors. I think something like 10% of Americans had money in the stock market, and so the trading was thin, and so it didn't take many shares to push the price up. It didn't take many shares to push the price down. Today, the market is very liquid, very small spreads between the bid and ask, very low to no cost to do the trading other than that spread between the bid and ask. And so The idea of small cap investing wasn't even known in the 30s. Not that people didn't know what a small company was, but we didn't have a Farmer or French that had done the studies to show the impact of the returns of small companies versus large, or value companies versus growth. In fact, if you go back to the mid-20s, the belief was that putting money in stocks was purely a speculation, almost like a gamble, and that the real investments were bonds for the long term. Well, that obviously has changed a lot, because today we see bonds being the long term, the risky investment, because they don't make very much, and they don't protect us from inflation. And let me go on to number three. What the frictions were. Again, these were 10 things you can't learn from a back test. So it's almost impossible in a back test to completely account for costs and frictions such as taxes, commissions, market impact from trading, market liquidity, etc. Sure, you can estimate these frictions, but you never truly understand how these things will affect your bottom line until you actually have to execute buy and sell orders. Now, that doesn't mean that they have not made some attempt to take that into consideration. I know in the work that Daryl has done, he has built costs into the management of the indexes that we have access to make them as real as we can. Number four, the difference between percentage returns and dollars invested. Returns on a spreadsheet are not the same thing as dollars gained or lost. It's much easier to look back at annual return numbers as a percentage than to feel what those percentages would mean for your net worth in real time. And it may be, when you look back, by the way, at numbers and you think of yourself going through the same process, it may be that some of the worst times came when you had very little money in the market. And it would have felt much different if those terrible times came at the point that you were had a very, very large portfolio. So it is difficult to apply those returns to what the real world would be like. Number five, how to optimize life. Portfolio optimization is something that has never made much sense to me. You can always build a perfect portfolio using past data, but a flawless investment strategy on paper doesn't take into account the fact that life is messy. Hard choices often have to be made that can't be optimized. So, yes, living through it is different than imagining it on a piece of paper. But what we did when we built the ultimate buy and hold strategy back in the 1990s was to take the approach that we weren't going to try to optimize the combination of equity asset classes. We did have to have the academic research to identify those equity asset classes, but we gave each one of them an equal percentage in the portfolio. We thought that would take some of the impact of optimization out of the process. Number six, how it feels to put real money to work. I still remember the first time I played blackjack at the casino when I was 18 years old, Ben says. It was maybe $50, but my adrenaline was flowing. I was equal parts nervous and excited. It wasn't much money, but I couldn't help this natural reaction. Now imagine these feelings with real money at stake. Envy, fear, greed, doubt, and panic are impossible to plan for in a Monte Carlo simulation. Number 7, an itchy trigger finger. Murphy's Law of Investing says that everything you buy will immediately fall, everything you sell will immediately rise, and every new strategy you implement will immediately underperform. When things don't go right in the real world, the first thing most investors look to do is change their model. Investors backtest investment strategies, looking back almost 100 years, but then change it after a poor 6-month stretch. It takes stone-cold discipline to stick with a rules-based system when it's not working. Most would rather make changes to relieve discomfort. Number 8, how it feels to lose money. Ben says, my favorite quote from the classic investment book, Where Are the Customer's Yachts, describes this perfectly. Like all of life's rich emotional experiences, the full flavor of losing important money cannot be conveyed by literature. You cannot convey to an inexperienced girl what it is truly like to be a wife and mother. There are certain things that cannot be adequately explained to a virgin by words or by pictures. The pain and emotions you feel from losing money is not something that can be simulated. No one knows how they will react until they are in that moment of maximum pain. Number 8, how to avoid overconfidence. It's easy to feel like a world beater when you're able to put together an amazing track record in a backtest. The data, smooth-looking graphs, unreal risk-adjusted return metrics, and insane performance numbers make you feel like you can conquer the markets. You have to be willing to play the role of, quote, red team, end quote, against your own models, an uneasy position for many investors to put themselves in. And number 10, what's going to happen in the future? As my colleague Michael Batnick put it recently, quote, unfortunately, there is no such thing as a front test, end quote. Every market environment is different than the last. So you have to be able to accept that the future will never look exactly like your time-tested strategy. And we really have worked hard to try to take the magic of the backtest out of the presentation. I think it's very common for people to look right at the bottom line or to look at the right-hand corner in a chart and see where the money grew to. That's one of the reasons we do not use many charts, but rather use the numbers so that you can see how far down was and how much money had been lost in the process. And I really think that, Daryl, given that backtesting can be so misused, has done a great job of keeping it real. And then on top of that, we have the wonderful calculator that Craig Apple created so that you can test our numbers over different starting periods and ending periods. And I want to go to another one of Ben's articles. It's entitled, Back Tests Are Unemotional, Humans Are Not. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I do want to talk about a portion where he talks about how professional money managers who select people to manage portions of pensions, what have they done as a way of looking at past results and applying that to the selection of managers. So in this In this particular article, he talks about the fact that he says, it is true that performance chasing can lead to suboptimal results if you're not careful. Because anytime we look at the past, whether it's the last 5 years or the last 50 years, we can be accused of performance chasing, because obviously the strategy that we select is not going to be one that has a bad track record, and typically not a bad track record recently. It may have had buried in those long-term results some bad results, but there's something uncomfortable about accepting something that recently has been a non-performer. He goes on, he says, and it's not just individual investors who fall prey to the siren song of short-term outperformance. Institutional investors who manage tens of millions or even billions of dollars do the same thing. Here's a chart I used in Organizational Alpha, evidently a book that he's written or a study, to show how institutional investors tend to invest in money managers that have outperformed in the recent past, only to see them underperform once they're hired. So these were, is a table here and a chart that shows the impact of institutional investment management hire and fire decisions from 1996 to 2003. And in the study, it shows prior to hiring the new managers, how they had done, and what happened to their performance after they were hired. And so if you looked back at the last 3 years, the excess returns that these managers created over the previous 3 years was almost 10%, over the past 2 years, about 9%, and over the last 1 year, about 4%. So what they're doing now is they're getting rid of a manager who has not been performing well lately and hiring one of these managers. And what happens is in the following year, on average, there is an underperformance of about a negative 1% over the following 2 years. It's again about almost a 1%, and over 3 years, a 3 year underperformance of about a half a percent a year. In other words, those hot performers, those hot managers, were not even able to keep up with the average performance. So he says, chasing alpha, or the ability to outperform the market and get a higher unit of return per unit of risk, chasing alpha is not a strategy. The biggest problem I have with most back tests is that it's always going to be easier to find a strategy that worked well in the past than discover one that works well in the future. He also says it's also impossible to backtest emotions. And he mentioned this in the previous article, but he says when you look at the 1987 crash, it looks like a blip on a long-term stock market chart, but it felt like the second coming of the Great Depression at the time. With the benefit of hindsight, every crash in history looks like a wonderful buying opportunity. No one knows when they will end in real time. And in fact, the very best performance, long-term performance, over a 40-year period, started in 1933. How many people would have been thrilled to go into a market that had caused the complete destruction of people's life savings as a great thing to do for the future. So he asks the question, so what are some helpful back tests? And the one example he shows here is a chart from J.P. Morgan, which he says is a personal favorite. And what it addresses is the distribution of excess lifetime returns on individual stocks versus the Russell 3000 from 1980 to 2020. And what it shows is that as you break down the returns of the individual stocks, it turns out that more stocks lost money than made money, even though the index itself did just fine. It shows how a small number of winners in the stock market more than make up for an even larger number of losers. Surprisingly, most individual stocks underperform the market itself. And then he goes on to mention, I've talked about Bessenbinder's research that shows that the individual stocks in the market had, most of them, something like 96% of them, had not made any more money than owning the T-bills over the long term. And yet, the market itself did just fine. So Ben goes on to say, my biggest takeaway from these back tests is the need for diversification in your holdings so you ensure the winners are part of your portfolio. It's much easier to pick the losers than the winners. And as strange as it may seem to first-time investors, the idea that you are going to do the best you're likely to do by owning all of the losers along with that relative handful of winners that make the market a long-term successful investor, that's the way it works best. He goes on to say, studying the past can't help you predict the future, but it can provide context in terms of the relationship between risk and reward. An understanding of the risk and return profiles for stocks, bonds, and cash can help you determine the right asset allocation for your specific needs and goals. And that is why, by the way, that we spend so much time trying to balance the discussion about returns with the risk that you have to take to get those returns, because that's the partnership. And part of that partnership is really very uncomfortable when the risks and the losses are being sustained, and that's all you can think about. Ben says, knowledge of the relationship between risk and reward can also keep you out of trouble when hucksters and charlatans make unrealistic promises of returns that are too good to be true. Risk is a lot easier to predict than returns, so a general understanding of volatility, drawdown profiles, and the probability of loss is important before investing in anything. Anyone can create a backtest that shows phenomenal past performance. It's the front test that gets you when reality differs from the spreadsheet. A good way to perform a backtest for an average investor is to gauge the potential for loss and what the impact would be on both your finances and your emotions. Backtests are unemotional. Humans are not. And I want to reference one more article, again by Ben, This actually is the latest one. It's entitled Roughly Right or Precisely Wrong. He says, I have a love-hate relationship with historical market data. On the one hand, since we can't predict the future, calculating probabilities from the past in the context of the present situation is our only hope when it comes to setting expectations for financial markets. On the other hand, an overemphasis on historical data can lead to overconfidence if it makes you believe that back tests can be treated as gospel. In some ways, markets are predictable in that human nature is the one constant across all environments. This is why the pendulum is constantly swinging from manias to panics. In other ways, markets are unpredictable because stuff that has never happened before seems to happen all the time. I like the old saying that I would rather be roughly right than precisely wrong. Historical market data doesn't tell you what's going to happen when it comes to investment outcomes, but it can help you understand a wider range of potential risks. It can also show you the magic of compounding when it comes to the stock market if you get too caught up on the risk side of the equation. Y Charts has a tool called Scenario Builder that allows you to look at the impact of investments, contributions, and withdrawals on different holdings and asset allocations over time. Here's a simple one. Let's say you put $5,000 into the S&P 500 ETF right around when it started at the beginning of 1994. On top of that, you also contribute $500 a month into the fund. Here's what this scenario looks like, and what you'll see is starting with very little money and adding money over the years, you will see that your investment of $181,000 grows by April of 2023 to over $915,000. So you start low, you end high, and all is well. He goes on to say, plenty of volatility along the way, but this simple dollar cost averaging strategy would have left you with a lot more money than you initially put into it. Even though things worked out swimmingly by the end of this scenario, there were some dark days along the way. You can see on the chart where the purple line dips below the blue line. In 2009, by the end of the stock market crash from the great financial crisis. In other words, you started, put $5,000 in 1994, $500 a month, and it grows, but between the decline of 2000 through 2002 and the decline of 2000. 7 and 8, you have almost the same amount of money as you started with. In fact, he says by March of 2009, you would have made $96,000 in contributions with an ending market value of a little more than $94,000. So you have no idea what the future is going to be. As of March of 2009, you know that you have put hard-earned money in the market. It has grown, and now twice in the 2000 through 2009 period, there have been major market declines, and there you're sitting with less money than you put in, and you're being asked to be patient. Now, think about that. You're being asked to be patient and trust the long term. So he says that's more than a decade and a half of investing where you ended up underwater. It wasn't prudent, but I understand why so many investors threw in the towel in 2008 and 2009. Things were bleak. Everything worked out phenomenally if you stuck with it, but investing in stocks can be painful at times. A lost decade sandwiched between two bull markets with a sprinkle of bear market toward the end worked out nicely using these assumptions. Just for fun, let's reverse this scenario to see what happened if you started out in 1994 with that balance and you started taking portfolio distributions. And as it turned out, you end up taking distributions of $1.7 million and having $4 million left over for your heirs. So it is not an easy process when you live it. And the beauty is, for the first-time investor, I mean, if they start out in a bear market, it's okay, because what you care about is where you are 40 years later. If this is somebody just starting retirement and you walk into a 2000 through 2009, you got a serious problem if you believe the S&P 500 was the answer. Now, you know what we've been telling you for years is that there's a big risk in putting all of your equity money in one equity asset class. They all have these periods of underperformance, severe underperformance, which is why for our granddaughter, we have put the money in a combination of the S&P 500 and small cap value. That did just fine during that 2000 through 2009 period. Ben says, life never works out like a spreadsheet or retirement calculator, or a scenario analysis tool. Things change. People make or spend more or less money. Markets, contributions, or withdrawals never occur in a linear fashion. Life is lumpy. Finances change. Risk appetite evolves. Things become complicated. But it's not a bad idea to map things out a little when it comes to your portfolio, budgeting, savings, spending, or anything in between. The future never turns out exactly like you think it will, but there is nothing wrong with setting some goalposts and then performing course corrections along the way as reality comes in better or worse than expected. Every investment plan should involve setting expectations and thinking through scenarios that may or may not actually happen. This is why financial planning is a process and not an event. You have to be willing to update and evolve when things work out better or worse than expected. I hope this gives you a sense of why I see Ben Carlson as one of the truth tellers in terms of finding an education on how to be a successful investor. And I'll have links to these three articles in the podcast notes. But the bottom line is, as we put together, along with Daryl and Chris, put together a look back at these 8 weeks of articles and podcasts and videos to explore what we consider to be the most important investment decisions that we are going to make. To put all those tables, there are, again, are over 200 tables that Daryl has now created to help us understand this process. And we are not for a moment suggesting that the future is going to look like the past. And by the way, it won't shock me if the S&P 500 for the next 50 years has a compound rate of return of somewhere between 9 and 11%. But what would shock me if I would be able to put together the series of ups and downs that it's likely to go through to get there. That's virtually the same almost as winning the lottery. There are so many different things that can happen. But I still believe that you want to have multiple asset classes in the equity part of your portfolio. I don't care whether all you're doing is putting together a large blend with a small value so that you combine growth and value, large and small. But that you do need to try, I think, to get that basic level of asset class diversification and then be absolutely rock solid in your commitment to saving. And hopefully, and we'll talk about this more, have by the time you get to retirement, have oversaved so that you have that wonderful luxury of being able to bob and weave with the market because you will be using the flexible or variable distribution strategy. That is my hope for you. Thanks, as always, for listening, and I look forward to having Daryl and Chris join me for that final discussion about all of these moving parts that we've been discussing.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.